This is Wyman and Bob
on Seattle Sports Station, powered through the Alaska Airlines Studio.
Streaming live on the Seattle Sports app and at seattlesports.com.
Now, here are your hosts, Dave Wyman and Bob Stelton.
Seahawks getting set to take on the Panthers this weekend, and it's always a good time to have a conversation with this guy. Anytime's a good time to bring in big Ray Roberts for a conversation talking football. He's with us on the Emerald Queen Casino Sportsbook Hotline. How are you, Ray?
I'm doing pretty good. How about you guys, man?
Good. It's good to talk to you as always, and want to get your take on a few things. First of all, before we get into the O-line and all of that, what did last week do for you in terms, or if anything, when it comes to Geno? Because we had talked a lot about, man, he's been spectacular. He's making the throws. The only thing we haven't seen is what does he do when the team's down and he's got to drive the field with limited time, limited timeouts, and they need him. It didn't happen the game before that when they went to OT. It happened this past week. Did that change anything for you?
Not really. I think it changed, things for other people, because there have been games where he's given the team leads late in the game, and then the leads were, given up or what have you. So sometimes we kind of nitpick what we consider like a game when it drives. And so it didn't really change anything for me. The dude was still dropping dimes like he's been doing all season and making plays. So it just happened that he was able to, or the team was able to even come through in that situation. Receivers, did a great job catching the ball. The offensive line did a good job pass blocking. So it was something that all of them experienced together.
Hey, Ray, kind of in a strange way, we're talking about how we like seeing that sideline confrontation with Geno and Ken Walker that I know got on the TV broadcast, because it shows that the guys care and that Geno, as a quarterback is, well, Dave said as a rookie, maybe Ken Walker wasn't doing something correctly. But what did you take from that? I know some people were saying, well, hey, why don't you guys make a big deal about this? And it was like, well, this happens in football. So what did you see out of that? And what did you like about maybe what came out of that? Or, nothing really came out of that, I guess.
Yeah, I think the good thing is that nothing came out of it, Geno's a really good leader. He's an authentic dude. Like, he's going to tell you exactly what he's doing and what he's feeling. And then K-9's probably trying to figure out his spot and place and voice and all that stuff, which is important. As long as it doesn't spill onto the field and disrupt play, or it spill into the locker room and create bad vibes in the locker room. And yeah, it happens. I've argued with coaches, I've argued with players, I've gotten on the phone and yelled at the dudes in the booth, I've done my share of screaming. I've done my share of screaming and yelling at folks, and I've been screaming and yelled at too. So but as long as that's it's in the heat, passion of the game, and you can just let it stay right there, then everything should be cool with it. I mean, I fight dudes, in practice, what I'm saying? And so I've been able to overcome that kind of stuff. So sometimes it just happens.
Wait, so you were calling up to the coach's box on that little sideline phone and yelling at them?
Oh, absolutely. When I played in Detroit, we'd practice all week trying to, this is the running game we're going to have, for Barry, and then we get in the game, and we're throwing the ball over the place, or I'm on the backside of the place trying to chase the safety, which is a losing situation for me. And so I just go to the sideline and grab the phone. I'm like, yo, bro, let a brother get into the game somehow. I want to hit somebody, And hey, we practice all these runs. Like, why are we throwing the ball all of a sudden? We got the best running back in the history of the world, and we're not giving him the ball. So I've had those conversations many times.
Well, let me ask you, let's get to what's going on with the running attack for this team. Now, they've had problems stopping the run the last three games. They've also had problems running the ball the last three games. So I'm curious now, there's obviously an injury in this last game against the Rams with Kenneth Walker only getting three carries. But, DJ Dallas, 10 carries, 37 yards. Tony Jones, 14 yards on 7 carries. You look at the game against the Bucs, the game against the Raiders, they didn't even surpass 70 yards in any of those games collectively. So is that the play calling? Is it the backs themselves? Is it the O-line? What are you seeing there?
Well, I have a long-winded answer to that, because I've watched a lot of film in the last few days. But the first one is that it takes all 12. And when I say all 12, I mean it takes the tight ends, the receivers, the quarterback, and the play caller. So it takes all of that for the run game to work. It takes the offensive line, blocking their guys, the tight ends and receivers blocking their guys, the quarterback putting you in favorable situations, and then the play caller also calling the plays that allow you to do the run game. So that's the first thing. And then I do think that because they have been so good at running the ball, that people are starting to crowd the line of scrimmage a little bit. And so they're making it a little bit harder. So I think you got to involve the tight ends a little bit more in the quick game to kind of, you know, maybe instead of running on first down or first play of the series, you know, get that 4 or 5 yards from the tight end in the quick game. And then you have a more favorable running situation because you can dictate to the defense kind of what's going on. And then from a player perspective, I do think that teams have figured out that if you can get Blythe one-on-one, that he's a weak spot in the run game. He's struggled the last couple games when he's had to just block a dude head up in the run game. Or if it's a double team and the linebacker is coming in such a way that it pulls the guard off the double team and then it leaves him manned up again with the big guys down in the middle, I think he's kind of teams have figured out that that's a weak spot in the run game. And so when you can't get movement in the middle of that split zone, inside zone, dual zone scheme that they like, then it makes it really hard to gain yardage there. And then if you look at Damian Lewis, I think Damian sometimes gets into a rhythm where he doesn't use his feet much. He tries to use his upper body strength to position dudes and turn guys and just kind of wall them off. And I think when he does that, your whole body and that guy is standing right in the hole. So it makes it a little bit harder for the running back to figure out what to do. So I think he needs to get his hand back in the dirt. They've been running out of these 2-point stances a little bit. It's kind of hard to get leverage that way and move people, you know, get his hand back in the dirt and start blocking with his lower body and finishing with his upper body. And then with the running backs, you know, I think when Kenneth Walker was in there, he's had a lot of success, you know, bouncing the ball to the outside. And sometimes you have to just, early in the games, you got to set that stuff up. And I think Turbo spoke a little bit to this last week, Robert Turbin, about, you know, like if early in the game, if you're running zone, inside zone to the left, and you're seeing how the linebackers are flowing and how the defensive line's playing it and how the double team is working, and you just get your 3 or 4 yards, and then you keep doing that, it kind of compresses the box. And then that gives you an opportunity to bounce it to the outside. It also brings the physicality back to it. You know, if the running back isn't doing his part of the physicality of the game, then that whole physical thing, you kind of lose it when you bounce it to the outside. So I think, you know, that is a tweak that they can make. And I think it'll be different with the different running backs they'll have in there if Kenneth Walker is out. And then the last thing is that everybody that's blocking has to be more precise with their hand placement, with the angles that they're taking, with their pad level, with their footwork, because there was a couple plays in the last week's game where on the backside, one time Charles Cross didn't quite get his head to the inside on the backside cutoff, and then that defender went down the line of scrimmage and made the tackle. If he gets that cutoff, it's probably like a 8 or 9 or 10 yard gain. There was another time where the same thing happened to Damian Lewis. It happened to him a couple times where the guy was almost head up to him and he got beat to the inside on the backside, and that guy ended up making the play. So just being more precise, there was a play where they ran a toss down away from the locker room, going into the end zone, and like DK came in to like block a second level defender and just kind of didn't quite get the right angle. So that guy got across DK's face and then got it, you know, got on the tackle. I think that was a play that K9 hurt his foot on. So just like when you have this reputation of being able to run the ball, then every little detail matters. And so every little step you take, every angle, like if your head is supposed to be on the outside number, it can't be down the middle. It has to be on the outside number. If it's supposed to be on the inside number, it can't be on the outside number. It has to be on the inside number. So like all those types of things, I think are little things that are impacting the run game.
Is the rookie wall a big deal for offensive linemen, and is that going to affect these offensive tackles? I mean, we're at the point now where they've played 12 games, they played a full offensive season or a college season. Do you think that's going to be a concern for these two tackles moving forward?
I don't think so. I think what they're running into is that there's more film. Like, you know, guys are starting to look at them and say, like, okay, this is where the weakness is, this is how I can set this rush up, you know, all these different, those different kinds of things. And so that is one of the hardest things as a rookie offensive lineman to learn, because there's so many little nuances in how people rush the quarterback. And then each week you're going against a different dude that has a different skill set, you know, that can impact your strength or weakness in a different way. And so it takes a while to kind of absorb all of that and learn all of that. But you're playing against dudes that are used to doing that, are used to game planning. So like Max Crosby for the Raiders, this dude is a beast. Like, I mean, the guy has a million moves. And so he did a really good job setting up everything that he was doing to Abe, you know, and whether he was using power, spinning inside, speed rushing to the outside, he does a really good job of just game planning what he does. And so I think that's what these young tackles are starting to see, is that guys are starting to going, okay, we got enough film on them now. We know, like, in certain situations or in this type of rush or this type of line scheme or this type of blitz, like, this might be where their weaknesses are, and then they start to exploit those weaknesses. So then it's up to them to then go, okay, like, let me do some self-scouting. Let me learn from how people are pass rushing me so that I have a better anticipation in those situations.
I know we talked to you about this at the beginning of the year and I think another time after that, but I remain in it. They're not perfect, but watching what two rookie tackles, and nobody knows better than you, Ray, how tough it is to play tackle at the NFL level as a rookie, and to see two of them doing what they're doing at this level, I still am just blown away by it, because I think it's so underrated how tough it is to play on that line at the pro level, especially when you're not used to the guy next to you. You're learning everybody. You're learning the NFL game. And to watch what they've been able to do, and Geno way more often than not, has a clean pocket. Again, not perfect, but, right, man, I think he's had great protection this year for the most part outside of this three-game stretch. They've been very good at running the ball, and a lot of it is on those two guys. It's everybody, certainly, but those two guys just continue to really, really impress me. Do you attribute that to them specifically? Is it you've got a new O-line coach this year? Is there something they're doing with them that's really benefited them, or what do you chalk that up to?
Well, you know, like my phrase back in the day was that they needed dudes that had PhDs in what they do.
Yep.
And these dudes played their position all through college. And so they know how to play the position. And that is a huge advantage to having a dude that's super athletic that you took from the defensive line and made him an offensive lineman or a guard that you're moving to tackle, or a tackle you're moving to guard. Like, it's a huge advantage when you've played, you know, 40, 50 games at that position. And so I think that's the first part. The second part is the dudes are super talented. Like, I mean, it's not that they played the position. They played it really well, and they both have different skill sets, but they're very good. You know, Abe is very strong, heavy hands, very good run blocker, you know, a very physical pass blocker. Cross is more smooth, athletic, you know, slides lateral movement really well, and he's learning to play with a little bit more power. The thing to me, Bob, that is amazing is that people don't understand this. When you're playing against the top pass rushers in this league, and because it's a passing league, every pass rusher is really good these days, and they're doing it without a whole lot of help. They don't get a whole lot of chips from the tight end. They don't get a whole lot of help from the fullback. I remember my rookie year, man, I played against a murderer's row of pass rushers. Like, I think 10 or 12 of my games, I played against dudes that averaged double-digit sacks for their careers, and they were all, like, Pro Bowl, multi-Pro Bowl dudes. And, yes, I would look over my shoulder and go, like, okay, the fullback's right there. You know what I'm saying? Like,
yeah.
Like, I'm going to get a chip from the fullback. Or we had big old Farrell Edmonds, who was a 6'8", 260-pound tight end. He would, like, bang into one of them just to slow them down, you know, before I had to take them on. So it is super impressive that two tackles are playing at the level that they're playing, and they're doing it with just me versus you, dude. Like, I'm going to lace them up and strap it on and, you know, button up my helmet, and we're going to go at it. And the best man's going to win that day. That part of it, to me, is super impressive.
Hey, Ray, from what you've seen out of Geno Smith and out of this offense this year, you know, the big question that we're already looking to is, well, what happens with Geno at the end of the year? With this high pick the Seahawks are going to get from the Broncos, do they take a quarterback? From what you've seen, is the proven commodity more important, or do you think you take the risk and put a new rookie quarterback in behind still a pretty young offensive line?
Well, I don't think that you I don't care if where you draft a quarterback in this draft, whether it's like, you know, in one of those, the late first round, a second round, or the fifth pick in a draft, like, you're not bringing that person in to start if Geno is still on the roster. Like, if it's a perfect scenario, then you can have Geno and have a guy that you like that you don't have to spend a whole lot of draft capital on that can come in and learn and you know, get a couple years under his belt behind Geno, because you learn. Look at all the stuff that Geno learned playing behind the guys he played against, you know, and played with. And so he gets the benefit of that stuff from Geno. And Geno doesn't seem like the type of dude that's going to say, well, it ain't my job to help. You know what I'm saying? He just seems like a dude that would help. But I'm not going to lie. Like, I was thinking to myself, like, okay, this Geno thing is going to fall off at some point. Mm-hmm. You know, like, I just had the doubt in my own mind. But, I mean, this, like, watching the film, even his incompletions are freaking great throws. You know what I'm saying? It's like, man, like, the only reason that they didn't catch the ball is maybe the DB made a good play or there was just a drop, but the dude is dropping dimes even on the incomplete passes. And so, and the poise that he plays with and the command of the offense and his leadership, that stuff ain't changing, man. This dude, maybe he's a late bloomer or he just finally got a chance where he knew that it was his team. But this dude has, you know, I don't know, more years left in him like this. This isn't just going to go away because he's been in too many tough situations. The team is achieving beyond what anybody ever thought for this just to be a fluke of a year.
Hey, as far as the defense goes, I know you don't just talk O-line and offense. So what are you seeing? We you know, we've been sort of lamenting what's going on with the run defense, especially since they faced the two worst rushing attacks in the NFL in the Buccaneers and the Rams. And then you faced the Raiders, who are decidedly better. But, you know, Jacobs was a question mark until game time. So you thought, all right, he's not going to be 100%. All three of those teams ran all over you, especially the Raiders. So what are you seeing that's different from the team that shut down Saquon Barkley and then had that good run?
Yeah, the thing that I see that's different, Bob, is that the defensive line is getting, like, magnetized. Like, they just get stuck on the block. And so for an offensive lineman, a stalemate usually means I'm winning. So, like, I may not move you off the line of scrimmage, but you're not on my side of the line of scrimmage. So if I get a stalemate to movement, I think I should win that block. And so that's what I see that's happening, which was one of the problems early in the season, is that guys were where they're supposed to be, but they were not getting off the blocks to make the plays. And or they weren't playing on the other side of the offensive line. If you look at even the Raiders game, there are a lot of plays where they stuffed the run. But then it was those big chunk plays that kind of blew the rushing yards kind of out of it. And then if you look at the game last week, if you take away the fly sweeps and the boot yardage, I think they only gave up maybe like 70 or 80 yards rushing. And so I think last week they were so concerned with in the box between the tackles running, because that's where they've been getting damaged a lot, that then they weren't ready for all the commitment to the fly sweep and the boots and things that the Rams had. So I think they have to get back to, I don't want to say being more aggressive or whatever, but you have to get to the other side of the line of scrimmage. Because when you do, the running back has to make a cut in the backfield before he wants to. If the running back can get to the line of scrimmage or into the line of scrimmage before he has to make a cut, then you're probably going to get 4 or 5 yards out of that carry every time, you know. And so I think they have to get back to that, you know, and I think they talked about the fits and things. So, you know, they have to, you know, there was a couple plays where Brooks kind of went with the fly sweep motion, but then the ball was coming back right towards him. And so then he didn't get out, you know, wasn't in position to make that play. And it was an 8 or 9 or 10 yard, you know, pickup twice. And so, like, different, those little things all matters in a run game, especially when you plan against really good running backs.
Hey, Ray, this morning, KJ mentioned on the radio here that he noticed that the Seahawks switched their defensive front after that second drive, and they went back to the over front. As an offensive lineman, did it matter to you if you were facing a team that had those three down linemen versus the four down linemen, and what was easier to attack against?
Well, fortunately, I played on some teams, even my bad teams here with the Seahawks, that we ran the ball really well. Mm-hmm. Like every offensive line I've ever blocked on, we had a 1,000-yard rusher, I think, except for one, and he had 900 yards, and that was the year after Barry retired. So when you can run the ball really well, it doesn't really matter. It doesn't matter if it's a 3-4 or 4-3 or 5-2 or whatever you got. You know what I'm saying? If you know that you have a good groove with that dude that's toting the rock, it really doesn't matter. Like, if for young offensive line, it could matter. Like, if you get confused with who to block, but the idea, once you know who to block, it doesn't really matter. And so I think that's where Blythe can help and has helped, is in the communication, because that's really important. Because if you think about it, Damian Lewis is still young too. You know, he missed some games, and this is like his third or fourth year. So, you know, the communication part is huge. So that's the biggest difference between, you know, a defense switching the fronts. It's just making sure you know who you're going to block. But if you can run the ball, you're a good run offense. It doesn't matter who they line up. It doesn't really matter.
Ray, always love having you on, my friend. Thanks so much, as always, for taking the time, and we'll talk again soon.
Yeah, well, thanks for letting me have my long-winded first answer.
Always.
I just really wanted to give the people, you know, yeah, I try to be a voice of the people, you know what I'm saying? So I try to break it down in a way that they understand it. And so put a little bit more thought into it than I normally would.
Well, let me leave you with this. The 917, I'm not sure where that's at, but they just texted in. Thank you for having Ray Roberts on. One of my favorite guests. He explains things so well for those of us who never played but are trying to continue to learn. Well done. How about that?
Hey, just made my day.
There you go. Appreciate you, man. We'll talk soon.
All right, brother. Peace.
There you go. There's Big Ray Roberts. Always good to talk to him. And if you missed any of that conversation or any of the show, just head to the podcast page, seattlesports.com. Click the podcast tab. Scroll down and click on our picture. And then what do?
Subscribe.
That's right. But these conversations, everything from the show is there for you after the show each and every day. But when you subscribe, it just shows up for you. You don't have to do anything. It's like Christmas, as I say. Every day, it's a new present. Meanwhile, there's a promising future for another team in Seattle. Tell you what we're talking about next. It is Wyman and Bob with Lefko in for Wyman. This is Seattle Sports Station on 710.
Wyman and Bob.
Powered through the Alaska Airlines Studio.
On Seattle Sports Station.
Again, thanks to Big Ray Roberts for joining us in the previous segment. If you guys missed that conversation, check out the podcast page after the show, seattlesports.com. Had some really, really good stuff from Big Ray. Always good with his information, right?
I love how excited
everybody's
he was.
Everybody's a dude.
Well, how excited he was to break that down at the start. He's like, can I go on and ramble?
Oh,
sure, absolutely.
Give you a long-winded answer? Yeah, that's why we put him in the long segment.
Yeah.
he can fill it. He's got info.
This isn't called sports not talk radio.
Yeah, he's got good stuff, though. I like it. And I think he likes talking about stuff outside of the O-line. I mean, that's his area of expertise, certainly. But, yeah, I think he appreciates being asked questions about something other than the O-line. So really good to talk to him. And again, if you missed that, head to seattlesports.com after the show. It'll be up on the podcast page. Meanwhile, something we didn't have a chance to get to with all the other news going on was the announcement that Michael Penix Jr. will be returning to the University of Washington. It seemed like, you know, most of my friends that are hardcore dog fans were sort of resigned to the fact he's going to be gone. He's going pro. Now, I'm not sure what his motivation was. I mean, I know what he said. I know what his statement is. But I'm wondering if this is a statement on Kalen DeBoer and what he's got going there, and Penix feeling like, you know what, I want to be a part of this. We've got sort of unfinished business this year. Felt like we could have done, 10 wins. It's a hell of a season. But obviously he's familiar with Kalen DeBoer from their time together before they came here. So if he felt some sort of loyalty, was it? Maybe he didn't get the news he wanted in terms of where he was projected to go in the draft, and another year would serve him better. I don't know. Either way, it's the Huskies' win. Having him back is a huge, huge thing for the University of Washington.
I don't want to be cynical and say, no, it's not because he liked being there and have a good bond, but I think it's more of a draft evaluation, probably not coming back like he wanted, and certainly the decision was early enough that he probably didn't get a thorough enough draft evaluation, but you just look and... We talked about this all last year because the Seahawks had a big quarterback question. Well, 2022 wasn't supposed to be the quarterback class. 2023, this quarterback class does have a lot of quarterbacks. Now, are they guys? Who knows? But certainly they're projected to go higher than Michael Penix, even a guy who might have had a tough season in Will Levis. But you just rattle off a few names there, like a Bryce Young, Will Levis, CJ Stroud, that are far and away projected to be top of the draft, you know, first round picks. if Penix isn't going to be that guy, sure, come back and prove your stock in who knows what the 2024 quarterback class looks like. But you can always better your opportunities. And then I think NIL plays a big deal in this. Name, image, and likeness. And now Michael Penix, the most prolific passer in college football this year.
Yeah,
cash in, absolutely. And these guys have started to cash in more than you'd expect in college that might not be able to as much in the pros. North Carolina had a basketball player come back, and I can't believe I forgot his name right now, but it was the guy that their center, who was so good, led them to the national title game. He came back because of all these NIL opportunities that popped up. So I think Michael Penix is now a name like Bryce Young this year, who's the face of the Dr. Pepper commercial.
That's,
that is everywhere. Bryce Young is just taking over your household.
What do you think he's making for that commercial?
A couple million, I think. That's a national campaign. I would say a million.
Goodness.
At least. I would say a million, because that's a national campaign that is on during every college football Saturday. You are flooded with it during championship weekend.
He actually does a good job in it.
Yeah, it's pretty funny. So if Michael Penix can get opportunities outside of just Seattle area businesses and regional opportunities, if someone has come to him and said, we want to make you the face of our national college football campaign, I wouldn't discount that. That is a huge reason why a guy might stay in college. And as a side effect, it's great for the Huskies football team.
It's huge for them. Again, you know, just not that my Husky friends are the gauge of what will or will not happen, but it just seemed like the consensus belief was, yeah, he's going to move on. He's going to move on. I mean, he's just coming off a year where he threw for over 4,000 yards and 29 touchdowns, 7 picks. I mean, he's one of the great quarterbacks in the game. He just put up a tremendous season. Now, I hadn't heard much in the way of projection about the draft. Like, yeah, he'd be the third quarterback taken, the fourth, the fifth. He's a third rounder. He's a fourth. Right? I hadn't heard much about that.
Well, before the season, he was nowhere.
Well, no, I know that. I'm just talking on the heels of this season.
But now I think that's maybe there's still too many question marks. You know, maybe he needs to prove that again. And there are definitively quarterbacks that are ahead of him.
So certainly, yeah.
If he's not going to be one of those
otherwise,
top
he'd be
five
at the Heisman ceremony.
Yeah, well, He should be, because that's a college performance. But if there are guys who have evaluated and clearly said, look, you might be the fifth, sixth best quarterback. And again, this is all conjecture, but he's clearly not a consensus top three pick. Why not come back, improve your opportunity? And yeah, they do have a legitimate chance to make the college football playoff. Now, we have no idea the scope of college football, because the transfer portal has made one year shifting alliances and teams just kind of pop up, like Penix here, like Caleb Williams at USC. So you truly don't know the portrait or the whole scope of what a team will look like. A team could be mediocre this year and could be really good next year.
What do you think?
Deion at Colorado.
I'm wondering what Sam Heward and Dylan Morris are thinking about that.
Well, I think they're done. I think they're gone.
You think they entered the transfer portal?
Yeah, because the prolific nature of quarterbacks who transfer. And because now if you are two quarterbacks who have sat there and not played for a year, and now you know you're not going to play again next year.
Barring injury.
Right. But there's not a competition. You're going into this season knowing there's no quarterback competition. You're only getting in if there's an injury. Last year, you know, it might have been a veiled competition, but at least there was the scope of, all right, this is a quarterback competition. Certainly Penix had to be the favorite because he had a background with Kalen DeBoer.
But he also had an injury history.
Right.
So you felt like, all right, there might, you know, you're not wishing for it, but there might be opportunities here based on his history.
Do you risk that, though, if you're one of those two that, like,
no, maybe not.
I'm going to sit here for an entire year and just hope, not hope, but just and think maybe there's a potential? Because there's so much quarterback movement, especially around college football. I think at this point, you certainly put your name in there. Just putting your name in the portal doesn't mean you go, but at this point, if you're one of those two backup quarterbacks, you have to look at it, because Michael Penix Jr. is entrenched as the Washington starting quarterback.
Again, coming off the season you just had, he should be. I mean, he was spectacular, and he's probably better than I think a lot of people anticipated. He was certainly better than I thought he would be. You know, tremendous season. He's got decent size, 6'3". He's listed at 214. Looks like he's a little bigger than that, but that's what he's listed at. We'll see if he gets bigger, what changes next year. You know, now he's not a surprise to anybody. Not that he was a huge surprise. I think the team overall was just a surprise. I don't know that anybody anticipated this being a 10-win Husky team, but he comes into the next season with a different spotlight on him and a different level of attention and a different level of familiarity. Now, he doesn't sneak up on anybody. Everybody knows what he does well and does not do well.
And that's your make or break, right? Because he has that spotlight. So you could catapult yourself into a really good pro opportunity, a potential first round pick, a potential top 10 pick or it doesn't work out. And I strongly believe there are some NIL opportunities coming. So if his season doesn't play out like it did this past season, he's still going to get that NIL money. And that's great for college athletics and good for him. And I do think maybe a secondary point of this, you're going to lose some guys if you're UW, but a team that was very close to winning 11 games this year probably should have. I mean, they should have beaten Arizona State. So a team that was just on the cusp of making the college football playoff, if you take that and leap forward and say, look, this is a team that has a legitimate chance to be a top four college football team next year, that looms as well.
Yeah, that's a big deal. It's a big deal for UW, so I guess congrats to them, and hopefully it turns out to be the right decision for Penix. He's able to capitalize and have another great year. And
I hope he's the new Dr. Pepper guy.
There you go. Yeah, that's right. Hey, don't forget, tomorrow night you can join hosts Michael Bumpus and Paul Moyer, 7 o'clock at Bellevue Square Center Court for the final live broadcast, final one of the season. They're going to preview this Sunday's Seahawks game, and they're going to be joined in person by Seahawks player Austin Blythe. Right there in person in living color. So that's tomorrow night at 7 o'clock at Bellevue Square Center Court. And tomorrow night, we're giving you a chance to win tickets to see the Seahawks play host to the 49ers on December 15th, Thursday Night Football. So you can learn more at seattlesports.com/events. Coming up, history was made in Seattle last night. We'll hear about it when we sweep the dial. Coming up with Wyman and Bob, this is Seattle Sports Station on 710.
Scanning the airwaves for the most interesting and entertaining stories of the day. Sweeping the dial. Every afternoon at 4:45 with Wyman and Bob.
From KJ Wright, I saw Jalen Carter. There is a guy I want more with that pick.
Big fella, about 6'5", 300 pounds, moving. I saw him take that guard from LSU and literally just put him in the dirt and made the TFL. He's as advertised.
Mm-hmm.
But, give me Willie Anderson.
Still want.
Did you say Willie Anderson?
Yeah, Will Anderson Jr., who, I mean, I know the Texans need a quarterback, but he's projected to be like the number one overall pick. So Will Anderson's a linebacker. Jalen Carter is the guy that I think people have thrown around now after watching the Seahawks run game struggle because he's this huge run-stuffing defensive tackle.
I've seen the picture of him holding the guy up in the air.
Yeah, so that was him saying, well, I like Jalen Carter, but give me Willie Anderson. I don't know. I think either way, you can't miss, right? As long as you don't take a quarterback. If you're the Seahawks,
what
right?
What a weird way to approach it. As long as you don't take a quarterback, you're fine.
206. I'll echo 206 here. For the love of God, do not waste a high draft pick on a quarterback. No, I won't go that far. But we've seen this Seahawks team this year. If you're going to get a pick in the top three, there are those two dudes here. I mean, who do you go with?
Maybe Jalen Carter.
Yeah, that would be great. I just think... No. Because you have two guys.
Are you asking about the quarterback?
No. I think...
Oh, between Willie Anderson...
No, I think, like, who do you go quarterback or do you take one of these two big proven dudes? Because one of those guys are going to be available.
Yeah, I'd probably go Carter. I just haven't... I need to get into the quarterback group that's coming out and what the feelings are about them. You know, I just haven't heard a ton up to this point. I've been more invested in the actual games that are going on instead of, you know, hey, this guy's projected to go number one overall or he's top five or, you know, getting into that draft mindset. So it doesn't feel like there's a lot of anticipation about this year's crop of quarterbacks. So it feels like, I don't know, is this the wrong year to have the top five pick that they've never had under Pete Carroll and John Schneider? Maybe.
Well, no, I think it's great because you have safe options there as long as you don't go quarterback. And that's why you stay away from them. Now, we'll have plenty
of
hang on.
The last time they had a top five option,
I know.
They didn't go quarterback and it didn't work out well with Aaron Curry.
But let's look at the 2009 quarterbacks now that we've thrown this out here. You just brought this to my attention. And we'll have plenty of weeks and months to talk about this so we don't have to get too deep into the woods. So Matthew Stafford, number one overall pick.
Mm-hmm.
After that... There was not a quarterback taken until Josh Freeman, 17th overall.
Tampa Bay.
Yeah, that was it for the first round. So that's going to be the issue, too. If you're the Seahawks, you're not getting the best quarterback because the Texans desperately need one. They're getting the number one pick. So are you okay with the second best quarterback?
They don't love their, what's his name, Davis Mills?
Yeah, they benched him for a game, and now he's the starter again. So, yeah, maybe there's one quarterback, and they're like Matthew Stafford was in 2009. But
maybe they trade out of the top five. Maybe they accumulate a whole bunch of picks. I don't know.
That'd be frustrating.
Would it surprise you?
No, that's Well,
I know that's what they normally do because they're at the end of the first round. But this is potentially, and we'll see where the Broncos pick lands. But right now, you're looking at a top five pick. That's uncharted territory for these guys.
That's why I think one of those two would be the safer bet. And it'd be exciting. I don't think you're getting Will Anderson. If you want to throw a prediction out there, I think it goes quarterback, Will Anderson, and then Jalen Carter sitting there at number three. And yes, the Broncos will finish with a third worst record. So there we go.
Sweeping the dial.
Kraken rookie Shane Wright scores his first NHL goal.
Gord, Bjorkstrand, Wright, scores! Shane Wright, his first goal in the National Hockey League.
There you go, your draft pick from this year. And I popped the game on, and right as he was being featured, they said called up conditioning something. There was a term that I hadn't heard before.
What
about calling him back up from where he was?
Oh yeah, he was sent down to the affiliate. A technical term,
but it was like a conditioning something or other. It was a term I hadn't heard. But anyway, good. Congrats to him. I mean, unfortunately, they lost. That's two in a row. They had one
conditioning stint.
No, it wasn't a stint. It was something else that was on the screen. But anyway, he comes up with his first goal after being called back up. Unfortunately, they lost, but you still believe they're more than a competent team.
Yeah, and what was pretty sweet about that, too, is that it came against Montreal, who notably passed on him in the draft, and he gave him that stare down, which he did say it wasn't. He goes, no, I was just locked in, but it was a stare down.
Did he give him a look like, how dare you not pick me?
On draft night, when he was drafted by the Kraken, number four pick, and his Canadians didn't draft the Canadian-born Shane Wright. There was a look. There was a bit of a stare toward the Montreal table. So for him to score that goal, that was pretty good. A little concerning about the way the Kraken have played. And not just in these two losses, but that game they ended up winning. 9-8.
Yeah.
You give up eight goals. Yeah. So they're coming back from very good to competent to good. But yeah, good to Shane Wright. And actually, we just saw some news about an hour ago. He is going to head out and report to Team Canada tomorrow. So he will not be there for a
little bit. By the way, you do expect them to be a playoff team.
Yeah. I think where they've established themselves
from the beginning of the season.
Yeah. I was surprised that they were competent. So now I'm impressed, and I think they'll make the playoffs.
I'm surprised they're competent. That's quite a compliment.
You saw year one. We all saw year one.
Yeah, it wasn't good.
Sweeping the dial.
Richard Sherman asked on his podcast about Baker Mayfield. He says he doesn't make sense for anyone.
Do you think Baker Mayfield makes any sense for the 49ers?
I don't think he makes any sense anywhere. And I'm sure he can back somebody up. But, you know, people give too many opportunities to these quarterbacks in the first round just because they got picked in the first round. If you treated them like you do fifth, sixth round, seventh round picks, then, you know, how would you look at their body of work versus, you know, hey, you got all the talent in the world and quote unquote ceiling and yada, yada, yada. You know, I'm sure somebody would give him another opportunity because he went so high in draft, but I wouldn't.
So that was obviously before the Rams news came out, but
yeah,
interesting thought, I thought, to keep in there.
I think, he still has a chip on his shoulder about being a fifth-round pick. he's not wrong about if Baker were a fourth-round, fifth-round, quarter, sixth-round, would he have gotten all these opportunities? No, but it also makes sense, especially with the team that drafted him, to give him those chances because you are invested. You invested draft capital in this guy, so you have to see it through in a way that you would not for a sixth-rounder, so I get him talking about getting opportunities with other teams, but you also did see him take a team that had not been to the playoffs, take them to the playoffs. He's done some good things that lead you to believe, okay, a coach looks at him, says, let me get him in my system. Let me get my quarterback's coach with him. We can turn him into something. So I kind of understand why he gets an opportunity.
I'm just confused by the Rams, though. Like, what are they even playing for this year?
Yeah, and I don't know. Maybe they're just looking at him like, hey, he's going to be a guy we sign as a backup on this team, and maybe Matt Stafford's injury is going to be lingering. I don't know. I think it's maybe they're looking at him as, is he worth keeping around as a backup? Let's take a look at him for the remainder of the season and see what's there.
But John Wolford's there. And he's great against the Seahawks.
Yeah. If only they played the Seahawks a year.
That's fair.
All right, coming up, we'll get some more insight on what's going on with this offensive line from Damian Lewis, who will be in our player spotlight. Coming up next, it's Wyman and Bob with Lefko in for Wyman. This is Seattle Sports Station on 710.